I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For people living with dementia, the world can be a difficult and often dangerous place to navigate, but cities can make themselves more welcoming and safer for these residents. Today we'll find out how Kansas City can become a more dementia-friendly place. Here to help us is an advocate and an organizer of a local film series designed for those affected and their loved ones. Then, if you've got a bumper sticker on your car, you're sending messages to other drivers every time you get behind the wheel. But how closely do the words and symbols on your bumper represent the real you, and are others seeing the messages as you intended? Leave that KCUR bumper sticker where it's at, and we'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's easy, maybe way too easy, to write people off who are living with dementia. But there's another reality to consider here, and that is that many people living with dementia have a gift for enjoying the moment and have enhanced creativity and imagination. Like all of us, they want meaningful relationships, new experiences, a chance to give back, and a chance to express themselves. Now a conversation about how to make Kansas City more dementia-friendly. With us, Deborah Schaus is back. She's a caregiver, dementia advocate, and writer. She's the author of Connecting in the Land of Dementia. Deborah, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Michelle Needens is Director of Education and Programs for the Heart of America chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Michelle, good morning to you too.
Thank you. Good morning.
How big a problem do we have on our hands here, Michelle, with dementia among our older population? Are the numbers growing? What are you seeing out there?
The numbers are growing for a variety of reasons, one of which is we are diagnosing earlier. We understand the importance of paying attention to those early signs. So we're beginning to see some changes in terms of early detection that helps. We also have an aging population. And with that aging population comes an increased number of individuals with Alzheimer's disease. By the time you hit 80, 85, you've got a 50% chance.
50% chance by 80 or 85. So we have a two-pronged approach here in terms of why the numbers are going up then, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Okay. Why does it happen? Why do people get dementia?
Gosh, that's a complicated question. There are two types of Alzheimer's disease, both of which involve genetic contribution. So family history does play a role, more so in one type than another. But we also know that cardiovascular risk factors prevail, so high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, and other factors, persistent depression through the years, head injury, Down syndrome. There are a variety of risk factors. And for the sporadic type, that constellation merges together and the disease becomes alive. And I'm quite sure there are risk factors we do not know yet that we have yet to identify.
You know, Deborah, we're talking today about making Kansas City more dementia friendly. What does that mean exactly when we say dementia friendly?
Well, that's an idea that is sweeping the country. And what it means is that a person living with dementia would not feel a stigma when they go out, that they would be able to walk into a grocery store, and if they need some help or if it's difficult for them to count the money back, that someone would be there to understand that. Or going to a movie or a cultural event, that they would feel very safe if they got restless or, you know, needed a break in between. And that's one reason we started with Michelle at the Alzheimer's Association, with the Kansas City Public Library, and with the Kansas City Film Fest, our Movies and Memories series that has been going on for over a year now, that is free for everyone and invites people who are living with dementia, their care partners, their friends, their families, to experience a delightful movie event that has lots of interaction, lots of surprises, and just welcomes them into a social event.
We'll talk about the movie Alive Inside that's going to be shown tomorrow night at the library in just a few minutes. But how do we measure whether Kansas City, in fact, becomes dementia-friendly or not? Can you tell the difference between one city and another when it comes to this?
Well, I think awareness is a big part, and I hope Michelle will answer also. But one of the things we are focusing on right now is culture and the arts, because as you mentioned earlier, creativity and imagination stay throughout the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a natural to try to be connecting through movies. We're starting again with the Alzheimer's Association and the Kansas City Public Library at Dementia Cafe. That'll start in March of next year, and that will be an opportunity for people living with dementia and their care partners to come together at a time of learning, social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of these types of activities, the more we have them throughout all aspects of our society, the more dementia-friendly we become.
Michelle, what's your vision for making Kansas City more dementia-friendly?
So really, every sector of the community, whether it be grocery stores, banks, whether it be clinics, parks and rec, libraries, as we talk about, museums, et cetera, that all of them have made adjustments that include everyone. And so that means people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. It might mean other neurologic diseases, that we can make these accommodations. So, for example, we see in grocery stores, we see the fast line. We're all interested in going through the fast line. There needs to be a slow line. Clinics need to have what we call memory aware slots so that individuals who are bringing their loved one with dementia don't have to sit and wait on the doctor for an hour, that when they have a memory aware slot, that it's timely, that we're not going to have affective problems in the waiting room.
Do other cities, are they ahead of us when it comes to dementia friendliness?
Much more so, yes. It started in the UK. And so UK is amazing in terms of their dementia-friendly work. Australia is ahead of us. In the U.S., it started in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so there are communities that have made some of those adjustments, and we have been recipient of some of their knowledge and lessons. Certainly they have done a lot. And as Deborah says, it's a growing movement, that these are things that we can do every day in small ways that make a huge difference for inclusion.
You know, Deborah, I'm wondering, what are some common misconceptions about dementia that are out there as we're talking about this? Because I bet there's a bunch.
Yes, there are. And I know when my mother was living with dementia, she went through what a lot of people go through, is their friends kind of abandon people because part of it is discomfort. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to act. And so one misconception is people who are living with dementia are done. And that is so untrue. And people who've had the privilege of knowing and working with people who are living with dementia know the gifts you get from them. Many are eager to learn. They want to continue their social interactions, as you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They want to continue to explore and to give back. And I think those things are so important.
Because people don't think of people with dementia in that way oftentimes, I think.
They don't. And I think one of the interesting things that's happening is there's a cadre of people who are living with early onset dementia who are advocates. And they are really helping spread the word about how you can live a productive life and still be living with dementia.
You know, it seems like it's so easy, Michelle, to discount people who have dementia. We overlook them. We knock them off the list, as Deborah just was suggesting, when it comes to friendships and lots of other ways, too.
Yes, we respond to what I call the bumps. So if someone loses a word, we assume that cognitively they're unable. Mm-hmm. If someone repeats.
Hey, you could be talking about me. I'm a talk show host, at least supposedly, in theory. Yeah.
You know, so any symptom manifestation, any exposure of that symptom, then we tend to generalize. And I always say, you know, Alzheimer's disease is a brain disease. It's not just a memory disease. And, you know, so we look at where are the challenges and where can we work around these bumps so that people don't get stuck or get shut down at certain places in the disease.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about how to make Kansas City a more dementia-friendly city. We're visiting with Deborah Schaus and Michelle Needens about all this. Let's go to the event that's bringing us together here today, Deborah. This screening of the film Alive Inside taking place tomorrow night at the Kansas City Public Library. What does a dementia-friendly film event look like? What's it feel like?
Well, this is an amazing documentary that actually brought the Music and Memory program, was a catalyst for bringing that to Kansas City, and I'll tell you how that happened very quickly. This documentary was a Sundance winner, and it was featured in the Kansas City Film Festival several years ago. My partner Ron and I were screeners for that festival, and when we saw this movie, we thought we have to bring it to Kansas City. And we thought we have to have the Alzheimer's Association involved. So they were all there. We were there. We were all so inspired by this movie, which talks about the Music and Memory Program, which is a way for people to stay connected to the music they love throughout their lives. And that program is now here in Kansas City through the Alzheimer's Association and other places, free of charge for people.
And all this speaks to the power of music, obviously.
It speaks to the power of music and also the collaboration of the arts working together. So this is another example of the Kansas City Library getting very interested in being a dementia partner with us, asking for training for their staff, and bringing this movie as part of their wellness series.
And this movie, Alive Inside, will be shown at 6:30 Tuesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Again, the film demonstrates music's ability to combat memory loss. How effective can music be, Michelle, when it comes to combating memory loss?
It is very effective in combating the affective symptoms of the disease and pulling those memories and thoughts and reactions from all different places. You know, we talked about speech a little bit ago. Speech lives in one place in the brain, but music requires every part of the brain. So you can have significant deficits and still respond to music. And for that to be attached to positive recollections.
I was going to say, why is music so powerful in that sense? What is it about music?
Yeah, it's the diversity that exists in the brain. So it's going to live longer than most other brain functions, the reaction to brain. You know, when we hear music, we have a emotional response in some way. And emotions also require lots of places in the brain. I mean, emotions also live the longest in the disease process. And so when we're attaching to those things that live instead of those things that are vulnerable, we advance capacity and we advance inclusion.
We're talking about ways to make Kansas City more dementia-friendly. Can regular folks who don't have dementia in the family make a difference on this issue, Deborah?
Absolutely, they can. One really easy way is to just keep in touch with friends and family who are living with dementia. Get to know someone, some different people, so you understand all the varieties of what they're going through, so you develop empathy, compassion, and then to be an advocate for them. One interesting thing that's just happened is there is an Alzheimer's stamp that has just come out. It's the effort of two women who have been working on this postal, semi-postal stamp for about 15 years.
Oh, really?
And so we can all make a difference by buying that stamp and contributing to funding for dementia.
Michelle?
I was just going to add, too, even in your neighborhoods, there's, you know, we can make our neighborhoods dementia-friendly. There are individuals who are quieter and more isolated in their homes. If you suspect, you could go over and say, you know, I'm taking a walk anyway. Come take a walk with me. We need to get people with dementia walking and remaining physically active. We can assist them with walking their dog. I mean, know your neighbors. Mm-hmm. You know, include
There's
individuals.
That's a concept that's been lost over the years. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And that can make a real difference, you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if a care partner of someone could just have a few-minute break while a neighbor walked with their loved one with the disease?
Because people don't realize the burden the caregivers give. They're often overlooked in this whole equation as we talk about dementia here. Caregivers are up against a lot, right?
Caregivers are on 24/7.
Yeah.
And we all need to be a part of supporting them and the individual with the disease.
Yeah.
Let's work together to allow people to be as capable as they can for as long as they can.
We're getting some calls here, even though I haven't put out the number, which is just great. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here if you want to join our conversation, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Alexa from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, this is just fast. I wanted, you probably know this, your guests know this, but the Nelson Atkins has a free tour for people with memory loss.
Mm.
It's mm-hmm. always the first Wednesday of every month.
Michelle's nodding her head here.
Yeah, it's from 1 to 2:30. And docents who have been especially trained to give this tour are staff it. So I think, you know, I just want to put that out there as another resource for people who have loved ones who have memory loss.
How well attended are those events, Alexa?
I think it varies.
Mm-hmm.
So it may depend on the weather or what's going on, but it varies.
Okay. I'm glad you pointed that out to us. Thanks very much.
I think it is also one of those things that you need to contact the Nelson and arrange for that tour. It's not a walk-in tour.
Ah, I got you.
I don't believe.
Glad you mentioned it. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Mary from Prairie Village. Mary, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you. I'm very interested in this topic. I have Alzheimer's myself. I'm only 63. I do not live with my caregivers yet because they're young and have kids and are very, very busy. And so I'm always looking for things that I can do more or less on my own. I have to take Uber, of course. But I'm wondering about, I missed part of what you were talking about in regards to the Nelson because I was on hold. But I'm wondering who can inform me of more things that I might do. And I also want to put in a real hurrah for the Alzheimer's Association. They have been wonderful for me.
I'm glad to hear that. Mary, how can you help, Michelle, how can you help Mary out here?
Yeah, there's a number of things going on, and we keep lists of those activities that individuals in the early stage can participate in. So I would just encourage a dialogue with whoever you're working with at the Alzheimer's Association. And we can make sure that you have a list, including the upcoming Nelson tours.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, wonderful. My other problem, of course, is transportation. But I can always get Uber, I guess.
I was going to say, how has Uber changed the transportation equation for folks suffering from dementia?
Well, you know, for many individuals with dementia, they could travel on their own longer in the disease process if there were more of a supportive environment. I think Uber helps. I think the Ride KC Disability Services helped, their new pilot program, relatively new, a year or so. I think that helps.
Mm-hmm.
Transportation continues to be a problem. If we were truly dementia-friendly community, we would have a lot more transportation options for individual in the early stage who could still navigate the community alone with just a little bit of support.
What's holding that back, the lack of transportation options for these people?
I think cost. There are various programs, including with Jewish Family and Children's Services, the JET program, but it's just compartmentalized. And so it's piecemeal a bit. Mm-hmm. And so there needs to be there has been in the past attempts to coalesce some of these programs, and we need to return to that process.
Okay. Mary, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And best of luck to you, okay?
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Ginny from Kansas City, Missouri. Ginny, you're on the air.
Hi. I just would like some suggestions of how to remain a friend with someone who's having the beginning signs of dementia and just be there to support them and try to get them out when they don't want to go anywhere because they're losing weight and their hair doesn't look good. And I just am really struggling with this.
Deborah, how can people help a little bit more here?
Well, first of all, thank you for being interested in that. It sounds like you are a true good friend. And I think just really being tuned in to what your friend needs and wants and listening to her, but also offering her different options. If conversation is getting complicated, sharing poetry together where maybe you do a call and response, the idea of going to look at art at the Nelson where it's totally friendly and nurturing and you don't have to have a knowledge of art, you just have fun appreciating the art. That is something fun to do together. Also a meaningful project, so something the two of you can do together, or maybe you can give back in some way, a cooking project, depending on what she likes, or something that has a concrete end so she has something to show that she's contributing.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You pay attention to depression. So if you have Alzheimer's disease, you have a very high chance of having depression. And so when we begin, depending on where someone is in the disease process, we might pay attention to those retreats symptoms and other symptoms and actively talk about the role of depression here.
Oh, why is there such a connection? I mean, I get it, but why would there be that connection?
Part of it's biological. Part of it's as it's attacking the emotional center of the brain. Certainly part of it is that coping strategies get impacted in a negative way. Part of that is losses, changes. We have to redefine ourselves. And in that process of redefining oneself, finding purpose, etc., people struggle.
I'd be remiss, Michelle, if I didn't ask about the STAR story yesterday that looked at Kansas nursing homes and their reliance on antipsychotic medications that can, actually harm patients who struggle with dementia. How big an issue is this across Kansas, maybe across the Midwest, for that matter?
It's a big issue, and it's not just about antipsychotic use. When we think of is this about sedation? Is this about chemical restraint? What we're really talking about, do we have options for real treatment for people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias? Sometimes antipsychotics are needed.
Mm-hmm.
They are grossly overused, and depression is profoundly underdetected. Meaningful activities are underdetected. We need to look at staffing patterns in facilities and specifically how they staff for meaningful activity. It is not enough just to toilet people and bathe people and make sure they're fed. We have to our bodies are not made to sit around all day and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do, there's a significant percentage of us that will get agitated.
The story said there could be thousands of residents in state nursing homes getting these drugs. Does that sound plausible?
They are common medications given. So that is absolutely plausible.
I should point out the award-winning dementia-related documentary Alive Inside will be shown at 6:30 Tuesday evening at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. If folks can just show up, Deborah, and
be there? Yes, they can just show up and be there, and I think you'll have a very meaningful experience. You don't need to have any experience with dementia. This will give you a lot of insights into what music can do and also how you can contribute.
6:30 at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library tomorrow evening. Deborah Schaus, author of Connecting in the Land of Dementia, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
Michelle Needens, Director of Education and Programs for the Heart of America Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk bumper stickers and what they say about you and what you read into them when you see them. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, we spoke with children's health experts to find out when a youngster's complaints of stomach pain are serious and when they're just belly aching. You can find that conversation at kcur.org. Tomorrow on Up to Date, we meet with local artist Jane Pronko, renowned for her paintings of urban landscapes, including Kansas City. Also, a daughter describes the lifelong fallout of her mother's decision to pass as white in the Jim Crow South. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, you ever wonder what other drivers think of you based solely on your bumper stickers? One KU researcher studies exactly that, how people interpret the bumper stickers they see out on roads and highways. With us is that researcher. That's Walter Gotlick. He's a sociology graduate research assistant at the University of Kansas. And Walter, thanks for coming in. So good
to
have you here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Why research bumper stickers? I mean, why not? But
sure, why not? I mean, I guess that's... Nothing stopping one.
Yes, right.
I've always been interested in material culture and driving, and you know, as an American, bumper stickers are kind of part of the sort of collective consciousness, if you will.
Do we know how popular they are out there?
Well, I mean, you see them everywhere. My research has always been qualitative, so I can't make claims in terms of how many cars have stickers or whatever.
You don't know if they're becoming more popular as the years progress then?
I couldn't say, really. You know, part of my research does look at stories that include bumper stickers, references to bumper stickers in the New York Times dating back to the early 20th century. And I've traced mentions of other forms of car inscription to an early pre-1910 transcontinental trip made by Eddie Glaffing.
Really?
Yeah. So
I was going to say, when did they first appear? Because it couldn't have been too much after the car first was invented by Henry Ford, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, the forms of the automobile go quite a bit back beyond Henry Ford, but Gladding, she makes reference of kind of pennants on the back of cars, in the first half of the 20th century, bumper stickers were largely cards that were kind of wired on, attached by wire to bumpers, and then advances, if you will call it that, in the construction of laminates and printing and so on and so forth. Adhesives made the kind of things that stick to cars more common in the second part of the 20th century.
Those didn't come along until after 1950 or so or something like
yeah.
that.
I don't have an exact date, but there's definitely been a sort of, as different materials have advanced, so have the stuff that we put on our cars, from bumper cards to stickers, now magnets.
I'm just getting this from my producer, Danny Alexander. Credit for the first bumper stickers usually goes to Forrest P. Gill, a silkscreen printer from Kansas City. In the 1940s, Gill pioneered the use of adhesives to stick bumper stickers to vehicles and made modern bumper stickers possible. How's that for quick research for you?
That's great. Actually, there are examples of different kinds of decals that were put on car windshields and other places on cars before the mid-40s.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a question of what you consider a bumper sticker to be. And I look at the kinds of what I term inscriptions that people put on their car, the way that they write on their car and the way that they use their car to write those messages back onto the world.
Hmm.
So it's a general, it's a more broader definition of sticker, I guess.
Sure. Are you the first researcher to take a serious look at bumper stickers?
Not at all.
Not at all. You're
not
kidding.
At all. No,
really?
Not at all. Not
I
at
thought
all.
You were a first. You were an original here.
No.
Someone else beat you to the punch.
Yeah.
It's not so.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, what is unique about my research is that I look at the interpretive acts made by drivers as readers. Whereas
what people read into
exactly.
a bumper sticker they
exactly.
see on the highway, for instance.
Yeah. So, you know, in order to activate the question, what kind of cultural work do bumper stickers do? One has to take into account a sort of conversational transaction. There's a writer and there's a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the research on bumper stickers has focused on the kind of work done by the writers, the why and the messages and so forth. And so what I tried to set out to do is look at how those messages are activated through the work that readers do and the way that they talk about it after they've encountered a bumper sticker on the road.
And the assumptions they make about the person who's slapped that sticker on the back of their car.
Absolutely, yeah.
We make all kinds of assumptions about people that way, don't we?
Yeah. And that's you know, I mean, let's say that part of what I look at is driving on the highway. And so the kind of reading of bumper stickers that I was looking at primarily is contextualized in needing to operate a car at speed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Flying down the highway at 65 or 70 miles an hour. There's a moment of passage, one car by the other. If a driver so chooses to read a sticker, if they can make it out, if mm-hmm. they want to entertain the meaning, the act of reading and interpretation is really conditioned by the speed and the restraint of the driver in the car and the distance that needs to be maintained between the cars. You can hardly stop someone on the highway and say, hey, why did you put that on your car?
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of devolves upon the driver, the reader, to engage in a certain mode of interpretation. And, you know, I identify a number of those, one of which is just labeling, you know, that activates all of our assumptions about the world
mm-hmm.
and just categorizes that kind of person as being whatever.
So do you find, is there a big disconnect between the person who puts the bumper sticker on his or her car and the person reading it? Is there a big sort of people aren't really understanding each other kind of effect here?
Well, I mean, it would be, I think I would feel oblivious if I was not to situate it within a larger context of discourse in America today
mm-hmm.
and a lot of talking past one another.
Yes.
And in that sense, it's really an apt metaphor for what it means to have a conversation about different opinions or to try to reconcile different opinions, which is to say not at all, in America now. On the other hand, there are certain features of bumper stickers that you find on cars now that challenge one's assumptions, that make it more difficult to just categorize a certain person as a sort of person. Oh, that's a Bernie supporter. That's a Trump supporter.
Right.
That's a Second Amendment supporter. That's a pro-life supporter, whatever the really divisive issues are. And it takes a little bit of puzzling. And maybe not everybody is interested in doing that, but to the degree that there isn't an immediate, consonance within an opinion you already have about the world,
mm-hmm.
To the degree that it may challenge your understanding, that opens up a possibility for thinking about the world differently and thinking about your own assumptions, recognizing them and thinking about your assumptions differently.
So just in general, then, as you look at this, Walter, would you advise the readers of bumper stickers to, hey, slow down and maybe not assume as much as you might be tempted to do as you read a bumper sticker out there?
Yeah, for sure. And again, I you know, I mentioned that we work with this kind of cognitive shorthand when we're driving, right? And it isn't necessarily the easiest thing. It's actually impossible to really try to carry on a conversation with another driver at 70 miles an hour on the highway. In fact, it's quite dangerous.
Yes. Does it happen?
it has happened. Actually, there was a case not so long ago in southern Missouri in which there was a driver who was irritated by the stickers he saw on somebody else's car and actually brandished a gun at the other driver. That was a couple of months ago. Certainly there are other instances of road rage, and there has been research done into road rage correlating with the kinds of stickers that people may have on their car and whether or not they have a sense of ownership of the space in their mm-hmm. car, how strong their sense of ownership of that space around their car is. I guess what I would say is, if nothing else, what reading bumper stickers do is it offers us an opportunity to examine our preconceptions about the world mm-hmm. and to think about them critically, because I think that that's something that's really necessary at this particular moment, not just on the road, but in American culture more generally.
Well, I bet our listeners have their own share of memorable bumper stickers they've seen out there. And if they want to share those with us, I'm all ears. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I asked on my Facebook page last night, and as you might imagine, I got a whole bunch of interesting responses here. Joe Michelon, used to be with the Elders, writes us this: if God is love and love is blind, then Ray Charles is God. That's good. That's a lot of words for a bumper sticker, though.
It is a lot of words for a bumper sticker.
A bumper sticker, what? You're talking 5 words, right? 6 words,
yeah,
maybe.
It depends. I mean, I would say more traditionally, the kind of bumper stickers that you would have seen in the sort of pre-internet, pre-cafe press era yeah. of bumper sticker, say, mass customization bumper stickers rather than mass-produced bumper stickers, they tend to be more... more of a whole thought into and of themselves. But more recently, bumper stickers tend to activate other discourses beyond themselves.
Because people can write their own bumper stickers
absolutely,
these days.
Absolutely. Which is something unique in the history of bumper stickers, insofar as there is much of one. Mm. But it is unique, and it affords a certain sort of intertextual conversation possibility between stickers. Mm. So you may have seen, for example, they're ubiquitous, really, the stick figure family. Mm-hmm. And in response to that, you know, my dinosaur ate your stick figure family, or I don't care about your stick figure family, but by all evidence, whoever put that sticker on their car did care enough about the stick figure family to make a joke about it.
Rita Marie Kane Reed wrote on my page, "My border collie is smarter than your honor student." There you go. Dan Leiberger writes, "I got this smart by eating the brains of my enemies."
Yep. So all of those are sort of more or less self-contained ideas. I saw someone else posted LFK, and I see that at least one of those is on the list of words that, although bumper stickers are often quite vulgar and funny, I can't repeat all of them.
I didn't know what LFK meant until I asked one of my assistant producers, Luke Martin, on what that stood for. Now I know, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So that would be an example of a different kind of sticker that activates a more specific cultural knowledge. Just about anybody in Lawrence is going to know what LFK means, mm-hmm. no question. Mm-hmm. But once you get beyond a certain geocultural radius away from Lawrence, they may not actually know what that means. And that's an opportunity to sort of puzzle over. You obviously had to have a conversation
right.
with one of your producers, which drove from a comment that was posted to a Facebook page about a bumper sticker that somebody else saw on the road.
Right.
So here you have a sort of a chain of conversation that's partly activated by the partial symbolic element in LFK.
Yeah.
But it's activated through sort of internet technologies and ends up in, you know, coming full circle. We're talking about it on the radio now.
Google it if you want to know what it stands for, because I can't say it on the air here. Matthew Ember writes, "Honk if you have poor impulse control." That's a bumper sticker he saw once. Another one from Mike Thrope, along the same lines of one we had earlier. My detention student can beat up your honor student. I think that's probably might be something to that. Suzanne Riffle writes, driving to KC from St. Louis years ago, cat a convertible with a long-haired dude driving, hair blowing in the wind. His bumper sticker, my other car is up my nose. Okay. You get the idea here. Okay. We have a full board of calls here. We're going to go to them right now. Our number, 816-235-2888. Mary Ann from Overland Park. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Steve?
Well, Mary Ann.
I just wanted real quickly, I have a couple of political ones on my car, but one is a Webster definition, first of a liberal, then right below it, a total exact opposite of a conservative. And it mean with conservative definition, but it is so funny. And I even got offered a job one time because that was on my car.
Is that right? That's
some man stopped me in a parking lot. He said, "You are so smart." And we started talking, and he said, "Well, what do you do?" And I told him where I used to work. And he said, "Oh, I'm the vice president of this little software company. Do you want a job?"
Just because of the bumper sticker, eh? Not bad.
Just because of a bumper sticker.
Thanks, Mary Ann. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. John from Prairie Village, good morning. What's your bumper sticker?
Morning, Steve. My bumper sticker goes back a ways. I was in college in 1972, and I was the only McGovern supporter in the dorm. And the night of the election, someone put a bumper sticker on my door that said they left the crazy one on the ticket. Referring to Tom Eagleton.
Yeah, I think that's right. John, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Mike from Lenexa. Mike, good morning.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Steve. This is Mike Kelly.
Hi, Mike.
I have a story about an artist out of Southeast Kansas. He's actually playing out of Lawrence. His name is Sky Smead, and his song is Bumper Sticker. All the lyrics are bumper stickers.
Oh.
And his video is on YouTube, and it's bumper to bumper. Everybody's got a bumper sticker. And then one lead into a lyric, one verse is, my German Shepherd is smarter than your honor roll. So look it up. It's really fun.
Oh, I appreciate that. Mike, have you heard of that singer, Walter?
You know, I think somebody has mentioned them to me, but I never actually looked it up. Bumper stickers activate all sorts of conversations, right? And people are forever sending me links or mentioning, hey, have you seen this thing or that thing or the other thing?
Right.
I think actually my wife may have even – is there a John Prine song about bumper stickers?
Could be. It sounds like something John Prine would do.
Yeah, so like I'm constantly getting things like this, and unfortunately I don't have a complete sort of catalog of all these things. But what it does point out is –
it could be a good book, Walter.
Absolutely. It does point out the degree to which something that seems so significant and superficial actually holds a lot of meaning in American culture.
You do a lot of your research, I read, in rest areas, you know, along highways, that kind of thing. What do you do? How are you regarded when you approach people in a rest area and ask them about their bumper stickers?
Yeah, so I have done that. Let's say the response is not overwhelmingly warm.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, speaks a little bit to the breaching of the degree of insulation that people feel in their cars, on the highways.
I'm safe here. This is my space, and you're not welcome here.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll say what I want and do what I want in the confines of my vehicle. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Interestingly, I was told once in a supermarket parking lot down in Georgia I should watch myself. I was taking pictures of people's bumper stickers for, you know, documentation, and somebody told me I might get shot if I wasn't careful.
Wow.
They weren't threatening to shoot me, but it was just sort of, you know, PSA.
Mm-hmm. We had this email from Gary here right after Inauguration Day. I had Cafe Presse custom print bumper stickers that read, I'm going to butcher this, Partre Demons, Latin for my country is insane. He enjoys the rare honks that he receives occasionally out there. Let's go back to some calls and Melissa from Blue Springs. Melissa, what bumper stickers are you aware of?
Well, in 2006, my daughter graduated from OU, and I was in Norman, Oklahoma for graduation. And I was stopped by a police officer, and I wasn't quite sure what I had done as a violation. But as he got out, he tapped the back window of my SUV where I had a bumper sticker that said Impeach Bush. And I got a ticket that day because he said I didn't come to a complete stop, but I think he was more motivated by my bumper sticker, which I have learned. I don't have any now.
That sticker cost you a few bucks, I bet, Melissa.
It did, and my husband reminds me of it periodically.
I bet he does. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Josh from Shawnee. Josh, you're on Up to Date. We're talking bumper stickers.
Yeah, I was curious about how bumper stickers have changed over the years. I've noticed people put them on laptops a lot more now and instrument cases. I'm not sure if you did any research with that, but just kind of curious on your thoughts.
What are you seeing out there, Walter?
Well, yeah, for sure. You see them on instrument cases, definitely on laptops as well. I have not been able to trace a linkage historically, but there is, once upon a time when people traveled with steamer trunks, often had stickers from the places that they had been. And, and so putting stickers on objects as a way of individuating the object and the owner of the object, I think, carries across a lot of different sort of fields or objects, let's say.
Do people in other countries use them?
So, I think that it's so I've traveled on a number of continents with a, let's say, a casual eye to the bumper sticker. Not as much as in America, but there are definitely culturally specific ways in which car customization is done in different countries. You know, in some places, for example, there's some interesting research done on bus painters in India. And, there's lower rates of individual car ownership, and these sort of private public buses are decorated in a way by master craftspeople. Really, it's a trade that's handed down from generation to generation. There's the Chicano lowrider culture in America, for example. There's the art car sort of subculture that's emerging now.
That's interesting.
In lots of different countries, you will find different forms of decoration or inscription on different vehicles.
Carol from Olathe, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
The funniest one I saw was on a little MG. It was a single word that said premature.
What do you think that was referring to?
The size of the car.
Oh. I got you now. That's good. That's good, Carol. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Well, you've given us lots of things to think about. I bet you wish that people could converse more about these bumper stickers in real time on highways, which, of course, is impossible, which gives people more license to say what they want to say, probably.
Right. And again, that is very much true. And many people have talked about how we kind of live in an echo chamber now. And I would think that the strongest lesson here is for one to examine their own preconceptions when they're reading bumper stickers or other inscriptions and the kinds of assumptions they're making about people who might, have those messages on their car.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. That's Walter Gottlieb. He's a sociology graduate research assistant over at KU. And thanks for coming in today, Walter. Good conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome.
Interesting
Thank
stuff.
You very much.
Yeah. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, an artist known for her paintings of Kansas City, then the cross-generational impacts of a woman's choice to pass as white. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.